Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning, well, many would say they're a match made in heaven. Both are exiles who found a home in Dublin and work together in the public eye. George Hook was born and reared in Cork, moving to Dublin as a young man. He's had a varied professional career from salesman and caterer to broadcaster, but rugby has been his defining passion in life. Brent Pope was born and reared on the South Island of New Zealand and came to Ireland as a young man. He's played rugby and trained rugby teams in both Ireland and in New Zealand. Together, they provide analysis on RTE Television's rugby coverage. You're both very welcome.
Morning.
Thanks, Miriam.
A match made in heaven.
Match made in hell, more than likely.
But look, you know, big matches, Ireland versus England, Lansdowne Road. How do you prepare for something like that?
Well, we do it very differently because we're not actually a match made in heaven, because we only meet when there's rugby. In other words, we don't go to each other's houses. We don't go out for pints of stout. It's very much a professional relationship. Although, as you can imagine, after the best part of two decades, it's a very close one. We do it differently also. We are intensely different. We've been not a lot in common in many ways in terms of personality. I do the whole thing about getting up early and reading newspapers, and I have a tradition about going and having a huge breakfast. Brent is much more relaxed about it, I find. That he talks about how uptight he is. He's a lot more relaxed than I am.
Is this true, Brent?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Even as a player, as a coach, I like to see things unfold as they happen. For me, it's even when I was coaching, I would stand down the end of the park rather than have a fistful of notes or whatever. I would just see what was happening then and then and assess it. I think George is probably, in fairness to say, has gone away and researched stuff probably more than I have. Doesn't mean to say we're any less knowledgeable. It's just with the different ways that we do it. But I wouldn't be so much into sort of reading. I don't know. I'm not so much reading what other people think. I try to give my views whether people like that or not. So that's the way to prepare. We do prepare differently.
Who knows the game more?
That's a really interesting question.
Different parts of it.
Because it's also national. It's also real representation of our cultural differences. I mean, if you come from New Zealand, you come from a country where, like, every man, woman and child is involved in the game, then you come with a different view on the game. When you come from Ireland, where rugby, you know, when I was growing up, there were only two rugby playing schools in Cork. When I came to Dublin at 19, you really could say that rugby was played in about two postal districts of Dublin. So you were always a kind of middle class minority type of sport. So that affects the way you think about it. New Zealanders, now he's going to go mad. Walk out from studio.
This is what I get every year now.
Yeah. New Zealanders, because of their positioning on the globe and everything else, are a much more, I think, sort of introverted people. A country formed by Scottish Presbyterians. So that's very... So Popey is a kind of a... You know, he's a kind of a Scottish Presbyterian, whereas Australia, founded by Irish Catholic criminals, is very different. So the personality comes into it.
George is right. I grew up in a country where it was the national sport, where as soon as you fell out of the cot or whatever, you played rugby. If you think of the people that watch, I mean, some of the audience we get might be upwards of a million for a big match. 80% of those people, including yourself, which you've admitted before, don't know about rugby.
What about your Scottish Presbyterianism in this country, which George says influences the way?
Well, I'm Irish Catholic, actually, but I mean, you know, the Scott. But
no,
he's
but
right
deep
about
down,
the country.
You're a Scottish Presbyterian. When it comes to buying a drink, you're a Scottish Presbyterian.
He always says this, and yet we've never been out. This is his big the thing about the Kiwis.
Do you get nervous on the day of a big match?
Well, people will find this difficult to be. I get incredibly nervous. I get nervous before radio, television, before any event. And then when the red light comes on, it all goes away. But I get... And that accounts for the preparation. So, like, I mean, Mark Twain once said that it takes 3 weeks to work out a worthwhile off-the-cuff remark. Jeez. So I believe in the kind of 3 weeks preparation. And I worry... like. I worry interminably that I'm not going to know the answer or whatever. So I'm very nervous.
Do you worry about upsetting players if you criticise
them?
No. Oh, jeez, are you joking me?
No. You see, I came to this so late in life. And I knew then, look, I've got this now. I'll either make it or I won't make it. So I'm not going to be worrying about what people think of me. So I have to say to those people listening who in their droves send me tweets and texts and all sorts of stuff telling me I'm an idiot, I'm fine.
But you're correct.
I'm fine with that.
Is he difficult, Brent?
Can be. It can be difficult because, as I said, he's come to it late. And I won't deny it. I mean, George can be difficult to work with because in a way, in a complimentary way to a certain degree, because he's a perfectionist. So, yeah, it can be difficult. But, I mean, I think everybody would know that about George. And it will be, for me especially, it will be a sad day when that partnership of ours breaks up. People like to hate George. You know, that's the villain thing. People
come on
and say, no, but they do. But he knows that.
There are two emotions. Well, not hate. There are two hugely powerful emotions in the human body. One is love and one is hate. And they're roughly equal. I'm perfectly happy whether they love me or hate me as long as they watch. My real worry is that they don't watch me. I remember reading about the great star of silent screen, Greta Garbo. And she had that great phrase in her Swedish accent, I want to be alone. Right? And she hated anybody seeing her. So, you know, now I don't want to be alone. So when I, on Sunday morning, I'm pushing the trolley in Super Quinn and Black Rock with the lovely Ingrid, and people are coming up to me and saying, hello, George, how are you? I would be devastated if they didn't come up to me. So roll on, like. That's why my number is in the telephone book. I mean, call me.
Everyone will be ringing them now today.
But imagine if you were doing what we did and nobody knew who we were, you'd be pretty teed off about it. So all that happens when...
Yeah.
You would. So when somebody comes up to you, Miriam, it's actually an affirmation of your work. So somebody comes up and when they say, I like your work or I don't like the work, what they say is, I watch you. Now, that is an affirmation of what you do. And I'm delighted.
I suppose I'm a little bit more sensitive. I mean, I
sensitive?
I am. I think I am a little bit more sensitive. I would be possibly quite sensitive. Sensitive to what people think about me. It's part of my nature. And I mean, I would get hurt a bit more than George. I don't look on Twitter. I'm not about that. But if I overhear somebody making a commentary about me, I feel like my first reaction is, but you don't really know me. And that hurts me sometimes.
He wants to be loved.
You know.
But he wants to be loved. No, Miriam, serious point about social media. Like, social media is a recent phenomenon and it is anonymous. Mm. So people say the cruelest things using anonymity. Now, to be honest to all you Twitterati out there, and there are 61,000 of them in my particular case, it's water off a duck's back to me. I have to say it's not to Brent. I mean, I joke about it. He is sensitive and he shouldn't read Twitter.
But I'm sure you're sensitive too.
No.
No. I don't believe that.
He is.
You must be sensitive, George.
It depends what you call sensitive. Like, am I? But I'm not sensitive to like Twitter or Facebook or the text machine, because I recognize it for what it is.
I would like to be like
I cannot be universally loved. Being universally loved means you've actually done nothing or said nothing. You know. So if you have an opinion, and there's a very important thing about what we do. There's this view that we, you know, you were wrong. You said Ireland will win and they lost or vice versa. It's not about being right or wrong. It's about having an opinion. Mm. So therefore, when the fella or woman sitting at home throws the shoe at the television, we've actually done what we're supposed to. We've an opinion. Now they agree or disagree. Yeah. But the person who had a huge influence on my television career was the great Bill O'Herlihy. Now, I always remember it was my first match. It was Ireland against Wales. And I was really impressed and everything. And Eric Miller was playing for Ireland, and I said, and Bill was the chairman of the panel, and I said, you know, Eric Miller has very high cardiovascular endurance. Yes. And then Bill said in his best Cork accent, what do you mean by that, boy? And of course, what he proved was, I was using words which people didn't understand, and it was a wonderful
But I think
lesson.
That's what the point, going back to what we talked about before, I think that the majority of people in this country, unlike New Zealand, if you go on New Zealand television, you know, you've got to be right up there. But if you look, it's not the national game. There are people out there that follow GAA, that follow sport, that love to watch that match last week. The number of people come after the match saying, look, Brent, I don't know the rules, I don't understand, but I tuned in and it was a great second half and it was brilliant, you know. And that is the people that we are appealing to. And the small minority are the people that come on and would say things like, oh, well, you know, George doesn't know that, or George didn't play with X, Y, and Z, or that, which is unfair because, again, if you looked at the football panel that's been so successful over the number of years, you know, yes, there have been better players play for Ireland than Eamon Dunphy, but Eamon has brought something to, you know, and people and people love them.
The great thing about RGE really is, I said earlier on, they're not ageist, so I leave my toupee at home when I go on television. I mean, you can be fat, bald, toothless and old like me, but
unless you're a woman,
if you look at American television, they tick all the boxes. RTÉ doesn't try and do that. They simply say, what we want to do is produce something that's good.
Yeah, the great panel, steered greatly as well by Tom and Bill. But listen, we're going to take a duet. Is this true that you both sang together?
Well, singing wouldn't be quite the description. George brought out a CD that he thought was going to storm the charts.
I brought out a CD.
And he bought them all himself.
I brought out a CD for charity, which are called duets.
Okay.
And I did one with my colleague, Mr. Pope.
What's it called?
You've Got a Friend, wasn't it?
You've Got a Friend in Me from Toy Story.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old pal said. You've got a friend in me.
That's a very sweet duet.
Yeah, he's up there with Brian Kennedy and Dan, I must say, as a partner.
Is he a friend, though? Like, you kind of say you're professional friends, but you sound there like you're friends.
Neither of us are going to answer that question.
Well,
yeah, I think, look, I'll start that. Yeah, I think so. I respect George immensely, and I respect the fact that he said before. I respect that here's a guy that was down on his luck and turned his life around at what, 59 or 60 years of age. And that, you know, I respect that. And I respect that we have our differences. We're different people. Are we friends in the sense of the word, you know, do we have a lot in common? Will we knock around together? Will we? No, you know, at the end of the day, we're not. But I think we have enough mutual respect to get on. And, you know, sometimes we have to bury the hatchet. We have argued on and off air on a number of occasions over the year. And what people don't sometimes ask is none of our arguments, none of our disagreements have ever been scripted. We haven't sat down there and said, okay, let's argue. We have, you know, George is a more forceful, controversial person than me, and I accept that. But sometimes I'm not going to sit back and say, look, I'm just going to agree
with that. What's George's best point?
George is a wordsmith. That's what I call him. He's got an incredible, he's an incredibly well-read man. I think he's an intelligent man. I mean, you know, that's the success of his radio show. George knows a lot about everything.
Sometimes and his worst?
Well, the same thing. He knows a lot about everything. You can't go out with, spend time in George's company, and it wouldn't matter whether you're an astrologist, a biochemist, George is going to know more than that guy by the end of it.
And George, for you, okay, what's Brent's best and worst point?
Well, his worst point, I think.
Oh, is, first.
Let's jump now. See how you go.
I'm just giving myself a little bit of time. The worst one pops into my head very quickly. He remains a quintessential New Zealander, and the thing is that I find New Zealanders men quite difficult, because I always think they have a great certainty about rugby, that they're the only people who know anything about rugby, and they think the rest of the world are merely follow your uppers. So in that sense, his quintessential New Zealand comes out sometimes in a kind of a superiority complex, I think. His best point is, actually, when you ask us about friends, I think the secret of friendship is that you can go away for 3 months, not talk to somebody, and come back after 3 months and pick it up as if it were a day later. That's what I find with him. There is a tremendous consistency about him. He is not a person who goes with the wind. So I know what he likes, I know what he dislikes, and he doesn't change those on a whim. And I love that consistency about him. So when the summer's over and we come back in the autumn for the internationals or whatever, that's what I love. The world is at peace.
Why are you laughing, Brad?
I'm laughing because if you were coming up Valentine's Day and if your wife said, well, what is it you like about me? Said, well, dear, you're consistent. Here's me saying, look, I respect him. He's a wordsmith. He's a guy. And Brent, you're consistent.
No, but consistency. I think he misunderstood.
Years ago,
consistency is one of the great virtues. I hate people who roll with the wind. I detest people who roll with the wind.
I'll take. But years ago, coming back from Christchurch, when I was about 12 or 13, I remember distinctly we were coming back in whatever car we had. And we're sitting. You know, my brother and I have only one brother, and my mother looked over at my brother and she turned to my father and she said, my brother's name is Mark. She said, isn't Mark such a handsome young man? And my father looked at my mother and said, and what about Bryn? She said, and he's pleasant. So that was the same. That was the same thing.
I do remind a very handsome bloke.
I do remind.
Isn't he, George?
I'm consistent.
George goes silent. So are you, George?
No, I'm not going silent at all. I was about to make a very important point that I actually believe in love between men. I'm not talking about gay love. In fact, the love between men and friends is in many ways much more powerful. And our wives sometimes don't understand that their husbands or boyfriends or whatever can have this intensity of relationship with a man. So therefore, when I look at him, I don't look at his steel grey hair and his good teeth and, you know, his large pectoral muscles. But I look
didn't
at
know
him,
what you're going to say.
Then. I look at him. I look at him as somebody I could depend on, and I think that is very true. I know I could depend on him if the chips were down, and I had to pick the phone up, and I had to say, like, I'm in deep doo doo here. I know I could depend on him.
That's nice. Really nice, actually,
yeah.
Isn't it?
That's
Brent?
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll take that.
You were talking about New Zealand there.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your background.
The story of my parents' marriage, I suppose, is a bit like the modern day Greece story. You know, Mum was a high achieving head girl at a kind of a wealthy family, wealthy farming family. Dad was, for the want of a better word, you know, extremely hard working, honourable freezing worker or abattoir worker. But the one thing about my father is that. You know, he could have been at one stage set up maybe by my mother's family in a sense of, but he didn't. He was a very proud man. He said, no, he said, I'm going to put food on the table. I'm going to work. If it was, you know, 20 hours a day, he worked. I mean, his dad worked. Most of my upbringing was dad away working, you know, up in the morning at 6 or 7 o'clock off to work, finish that job, go to another job, work weekends. In New Zealand, it was a great lifestyle in the sense of you, there's so many sports you could play. I tell people over here now, like, you know, one of the electives at school was to go skiing, you know. On a Wednesday afternoon, you go skiing, the winter surfing in the summer. You know, I rode horses. We were out from, you know, sort of dusk to dawn. That sort of lifestyle, being out and swimming and, you know, just brilliant.
And one sibling, one brother, Mark.
One brother, Mark, yeah.
And troubled relationship a little bit with him?
Well, not troubled, slightly strained. You know, I think I feel a certain amount of guilt later in life because of the way that he had to grow up. I was a kind of a macho guy in New Zealand in that sense. I was playing rugby. I was, you know, I was kind of, I suppose, skin your knees, you know, get in fights, that sort of thing. Like a lot of kids, he wasn't. He was a very sensitive, you know, sort of young guy. You know, he was gay. I knew, funny enough, before anybody. I just had that. I had that gut feeling. So we weren't close. I mean, here's me, you know, wanting to have a brother to talk about bikinis and girls and drink and all those things that adolescents do, and I couldn't really share that with him. Neither could he with me. I mean, he was going through his own trip, and it must have been extremely hard looking back. A small rural town, you know, we didn't know of any gay people. I certainly didn't know of any. He didn't know of any at school. For him to go through that must have been, and I regret, and I still do now, and it's very emotional for me, I still regret that I didn't shun him, but I didn't kind of, you know, when you're in the locker rooms and when you're hearing the rugby stories and when, you know, there was a fair amount, I suppose, you know, wouldn't have been sort of gay bashing as such, but I wasn't strong enough to say, hey, you know my brother, he's a great guy, I love him dearly, take it somewhere else. Other people say that's fine. You know, I was going through my own battles too. But I do kind of regret that we're not closer as brothers. But I know he has his own life. I have my own life. And we love each other. And that's the important thing. But I do think that it must have been extremely, extremely hard for him to face up to all of that in those years in New Zealand, as it would have been for someone in rural Ireland to do the same thing. And, you know, I do regret that maybe I couldn't have been, not a better person, but a different person.
You were much younger as well.
I was younger and I was trying to make the All Blacks, and I was in that situation where you were seen to be macho and it was talking about women and girlfriends and all this. So that kind of gay society didn't come into rugby in New Zealand. It wasn't. But he was having his own battles, and, you know, he subsequently had issues with depression and that as well. And I think a lot of that is trying to probably come to terms. See, not all people. And George, I know George was on speaking a couple of weeks ago about the gay marriages and did so very eloquently in that. But, I mean, I think that it's very hard, because I remember having a discussion with my brother and he said, look, Brent, I don't necessarily want to be gay. He said, I'd love to be thinking of the white picket fence and the two kids and the wife and that. But he said, I don't find woman sexually attractive. And that was the bottom line. It wasn't something he chose to be. It was a genetic thing. And that's fine. He loves his life, you know, and I'm proud of him.
And your childhood, Georgia, was in Cork, wasn't it?
Yeah. Both my parents left school at 14, but my mother and father were educated by the Cork City Library, and they gave me the same love of books. So I remember as a kid, like, there would be dead silence in the kitchen, and there'd be just people, you know, we'd just be reading books. But my father was also a dance band drummer. So he would come home from work at 5:30, grab a couple of hours sleep, and then he didn't have a car. So you can imagine him walking off with the big bass drum on one hip, put the side drum on the other hip, with, you know, the cymbals under his arm, and he'd walk up to the corner and I'd wave goodbye to him as he went off to a dance somewhere to play. But that money was crucial, because that money sent me to Pres Cork, which is a fee-paying school, way above of where the school I should have been at. I think there were three of us in Jewtown at that time who did the Leaving Cert. Everybody else left school at 14. And without that, I wouldn't be here today, because education is the key that unlocks everything. So the drumming did that. And when I talk to people, particularly about when I got a job or something, and I always start off the interview the same way. To understand George, you should have met his mother. Because I am my mother's son. And, like,
people shaking their hands.
Like, my mother was the most generous woman I ever knew, but she was the worst enemy you could ever have.
Were you close to your mother?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, she thought I was God. I mean,
you're an only child, of course, for
a while. Yeah, but, I mean, her generosity was such she would adopt to other children, you know. And
thought he was God, and George has taken on that mantle.
No, but she did. And I remember when I married Ingrid, and my mother was sitting next to her at the wedding reception. There's Ingrid, like this tough Austrian broad. And my mother is saying, now, Ingrid, I normally warm George's underwear before he puts them on in the mornings. And then he likes his eggs a particular way, Ingrid. And then so on, you know, and the steam coming out.
Is she still
Ingrid's ears.
Warming your underwear?
So, yeah, it was a big change for me when I got married, I can tell you.
So were they cousins of yours who were your mum and dad adopted?
Yeah, I mean, my mother, it's so tragic, really. My mother, the most generous woman that the earth put on earth. And she discovers that there is a child in an orphanage to which she is related in London. Remember, it's just the end of World War II. And she goes over and this little boy is crying. And I was with her and I'm only a titch. And she says to the nun, she says, why is the little boy crying? The nun says, oh, well, he's going to be missing his sister. And my mother says, what do you mean his sister? Oh, there's a sister. So my mother took both. When she couldn't really afford me, she took two more. But then, having done that, which, you know, deserved the Victoria Cross for humanity, she then made a complete mess of it emotionally with my brother and sister. And she could never do it equally. You know, if there was a cake, she couldn't divide a cake in three. like, I got the biggest slice of cake.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You know, it was very difficult for her. And to her dying day, and it's so sad, really, to her dying day, she always felt that she had shortchanged me, if you like, in my birthright. Now, I never felt that in the slightest, but she did.
They were very good to her, though, weren't they?
Well,
your brother
particularly
and sister.
My brother. Yeah. I was terrible. I mean, Popey talks about regrets. I mean, that's the one thing we really do have in common. We have huge regrets about aspects of our family life. And then my father, that's where I got all the talking from both of them, because they were both great talkers. And I used to, Sunday mornings, he used to take me to Mass in St. Augustine's in Cork, 11:15 Mass. And then we'd walk for hours and he'd talk to me, debate with him. So like I was debating with my father from about the age 10, and he would say to me, hold your opinion, hold your opinion.
And you really listened to your father, didn't you, George?
Yeah.
But look, that's why you also love Glenn Miller's American Patrol, is it? Because that's what we're going to take now.
Every time I hear the American Patrol and that drum solo in it, I think of my father.
Glenn Miller's there, American Patrol. You were doing the drum actions halfway through that week.
Yeah, I mean, I adored my father. I was very lucky with my parents. Now, my mother, because she spoiled me, I didn't leave home until 28, you know. And obviously, to this very day, toast is the maximum culinary achievement that I have. And she also emotionally didn't prepare me for marriage. I thought marriage was a kind of an upmarket bed and breakfast. You know? So, like, I had no understanding.
You're very honest about it.
Of being a husband.
Did Ingrid know it was an upmarket bed and breakfast?
Well
tell her about the rugby match, you know, the engagement, the wedding day.
No, you see, I met her at a dance in Lytham St Anne Squash Club in Lancashire. And I asked her to marry me on the second date. And of course, she was in Britain, I was in Ireland. So I wrote to her every single day for 2 years.
And God, you're romantic. Yeah.
And then cancelled the wedding for a rugby match.
That's not so romantic. He was doing so well. He had everybody out there going, George, and then,
And then she discovered, like, that she was married to an extremely dysfunctional guy for 30 years. I mean, for 30 years, I gave her a dog's life. I really did. I was a failed husband, father, all sorts of stuff. I had no idea, like. And then I copped on. And funny enough, like, I copped on because I got a job that I loved, which was RTE.
Did you really treat her badly? Like, you often say that when you talk about the lovely Ingrid, but I think you're a bit of a pussycat, really.
No, of course I treated her badly. I mean, you know, you treat a woman badly if you don't turn up when you're supposed to. Of course I treated her badly.
And why did she stick with you?
That is a great question. And I think I can answer it. One, I think she actually loved me, which was one thing. But deep down, Ingrid's father was German, her mother Austrian. She would see herself as Austrian. She has that Teutonic stubbornness to make it work. So she, despite this terrible man who didn't earn a wage, left her, you know, creditors to come into the door saying, where's your husband? All this sort of stuff. She battled on out of sheer pride and courage and doggedness.
Would you recommend marriage to Brent?
Yes. I know the girl, like, in my head. I know the girl.
For Brent?
Yeah, for Brent.
Does she exist?
Well, in my imagination.
Okay, describe her. What's she like?
She's very tall and willowy, whereas I like mine short and dumpy.
Ingrid, you are not short and dumpy.
She's taller. I think he needs a woman younger than him who worships him. He needs a woman who would worship. Strangely enough, yeah, I mean that. I think he needs an Irish girl who would worship him and every day tell him, Popey, You're the greatest thing ever, and I adore you. And more importantly, give him two children, because he would be a wonderful father.
Okay, Brian, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm at my age, and would I have loved to have been married and had kids? Yeah, you know, possibly. And I would be a great dad, and that would be a regret. I mean, it's my doing. I've met some wonderful women, and I love them dearly, and I, you know, respect enough not to, to mention names. But I've messed up, you know, when George has messed up. I've messed up in most relations. Not that I've messed up in the sense that I've done anything bad. I've messed up in because... This is going to sound, it's quite emotional for me, because I've found it hard to think. And George is right. The worship's not the word, but I never had any confidence with women or any self-esteem with women. I always felt that if I was with someone, they were going to leave me. And I don't know where they came from. And I always felt that I wasn't lovable. Even though they would tell me that I was, I always felt that. And that's something I carried right through into my 40s, and I've had to learn to change. And I felt, and it's not kind of woe is me, I just felt like, this gorgeous woman is with me and stuff, and I'm treating them kind, I'm doing the right thing, but she's going to find someone else. And that always put me in a situation where I was kind of always backing up, terminology, backing up the truck all the time. And they'd say, but I love you, Brenda, or something. And I would in my heart, I just think that she's going to leave, she's going to go. So in that sense, it's not even the worshipping. It's just somebody to tell me I'm okay, you know, because I didn't feel that for a lot
part
of my life.
Where does that come from?
I don't know, Mary, man. It's something I've carried around my whole life. And I think, you know, I even talk about in the book, I have never had an enjoyment for some reason, the achievements that I've done, be it writing kids' books, be it opening galleries. I've had a wonderful, varied and achievable life in other people's eyes. I just haven't seen it myself. And that, I suppose, that permutated over into relationships, whereby people would say, but she loves you. And I'd say, but she's gorgeous and she's these things. And they say, but so what? And I'd say, well, surely she's going to find someone. And they say, but she's with you. You know, I couldn't take that she was. And that's why I'm by myself. That is the only reason.
I'm listening to Popey there. It's a very understandable emotional response that he is giving to me. I understand it. I understand him very well. But what he wants is he needs somebody. He needs reassurance. Yeah. I think that's a very natural thing. Everybody needs reassurance.
Yeah, but did you get lots of confidence because your mother gave
it
to you?
I mean, George speaks very, I mean, it's lovely, and he talks about him talking to his parents. I didn't talk, you see.
Yeah.
I didn't have, and it's no respect, and it's no reflection on my brother Mark, you know, who I love dearly and I am proud of him. It's no reflection, but we didn't talk about anything. So in a way, I grew up a kind of a loner, in a way,
yeah.
Because we weren't a family that talked particularly. Dad was away at work, you know, Mum and I wouldn't talk until later in life. So yeah, and that was it. But I think it's the whole thing is I just didn't have any confidence. I was a good young rugby player and I was good at sport, but I never wanted my parents to come and watch me play. I'd give them different grounds. They said they couldn't see me. If I ever, I didn't bring girlfriends home, I didn't go out with girls at university. I felt very alone when I went to university first because I didn't fit in the rugby. See, I was always different, Miriam. I'm not a stereotypical rugby head. You know, I liked art, I liked music, I liked dressing differently. I was good at rugby, and a bit like George, that gave me my slice of life, and I'm thankful for that. But I was different. I liked doing different things, even as much as writing kids' books that many years ago. It wasn't the done thing to do for a macho guy. In New Zealand, you had to follow the stereotypical lines, which was tough, mean, you know, and I would get down, and I had, you know, I had mental health problems throughout the time because I was an emotional kid. And I think that's where I missed out. And that is the real reason. And George is right. The real reason is not so much that I need somebody to adore me. I need someone, as I said before, that, Brent, you're okay. And I will do anything for anybody if I feel that they think that about me. It's no problem for me to do anything. And as a partner, I believe I'm a great partner now. I didn't believe I was, not through any actions of myself. I was good on the outside, being generous and kind and all these things and doing anything for any woman I was with. I just couldn't see that why they would love me, you know, and that was it. And that's the reason.
Do an ad for him, George, if there's a woman out there listening. Do an ad for why they should marry Brent.
I'd be mortified.
50-year-old colonial expatriate with high testosterone levels seeking young, svelte, blonde, fond of high heels, can give wonderful life, as he will do. He is utterly domesticated, can cook, clean, and
I am
wash.
Good at all those things.
All you have to, all the woman has to give is her undying affection and good home offered.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
No, we're going to take a piece of music, actually, you love, Brent, which is He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother.
I just love the story about, I think, Jonestown or whatever, wherever it was in the States, about a priest that was talked to a young boy that was walking around. His brother was up on him back and had the stirrups. He had polio. And I think the priest, the father, said to him at the time, you know, isn't he heavy? And he looked at him and said, you know, he ain't heavy, father, he's my brother. I just think it's one of those songs that if I listen to, it gives me... I don't know. It makes you feel good to be alive. It makes me feel good. I'm a very giving person. I'm not saying that ego polishing or halo polishing. I love to give, and I love what I receive giving. And I just think that, you know, everybody's brother, and, you know, nobody's heavy. And it's emotional for me. I'll be in tears when I hear that song, because I think get out and make a difference to someone else's life when I hear that song. That's what I try to do.
The road is long.
Gorgeous song there. He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother. Your choice, Brent.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know how much longer we've got, Miriam, but I'm going to give him a bit of advice.
Great.
He talks about giving, and he is the most giving of people. He gives too much, and I say it to him sometimes, and sometimes I just think it, that he should start thinking about Brent Pope a bit more rather than underprivileged humanity. There's nothing wrong with being just a little selfish, and I think sometimes he forgets Brent Pope in the shakeout when he's thinking about the world.
And interestingly, both of you have spoken at length in the past about the fact you suffered from depression, various forms of it. But this is a charity also you're involved in together about suicide, isn't it?
Yeah, we both do work in that regard. Like, we're very different even in our relationships there, in relationships to our mental health. Like, when Poppy talks about it so graphically... He talks about how difficult it makes his life. Whereas for me, I'm a bit like my great hero, Winston Churchill, where I call it the black dog. It comes and goes. But I've learned, I've learned to cope with that. It's harder for Brent, you know.
Well, I think we're both resilient. I think that's the word. I don't ever want to go down. George is the same. I don't want to. And I said, I'm not a poster child for mental health. I can't even scratch the surface on what some people are suffering from. I have different issues but the description I use, we box and weave, you know, like I won't let anything beat me like that. I'll say, okay, yeah, there'll be days where I sort of find that, you know, I'd love to be able to achieve, I'd love to have that euphoria, but no, fine. I'll duck and weave, and I'll get there and I'll love my life and I'll enjoy it.
How important is rugby in terms of making you both resilient to other vicissitudes in life?
Well, if I had my time all over again, because my commitment to rugby was such that I ignored my wife and family, so therefore I probably would do it differently. But when my business was falling apart, everything was falling apart, rugby was the one thing that I was good at. You know, so I was saying to myself, look, you're a failure as a husband, you're a failure as a father, you're a failure as a businessman. You know, and that lack of self-esteem would have been there. But I said to myself, well, you're a good coach, you know. So I was doing something right. And then the most important thing, and I say it to all kinds of people listening, particularly young people about a job, you have to be an expert at something to get a job. So the fact that rugby then gave me an opportunity to do what I've always wanted to do, which is talk about it.
And you, Brent, has it been good for
you? Yeah, I love the RSA. It swings and roundabouts for me, because rugby also gave me some of the dark days. I mean, when I was injured, when I missed out on the All Black World Cup squad in 1987, it affected me psychologically. For someone to pull the you know, the rag out from your dream, something you've dreamed about since you're 5 or 6 years of age, putting on your little rugby kit and going down. For that to be taken away from you, it was extremely hard. That being said, it forced me to come to Ireland to change my life. It forced me to come to Ireland. Like George, I loved rugby. I loved playing. It was luck. It was luck more than anything that started me off in RT. And I've been there ever since. And George is right. I mean, it's something that I continually pinch myself. I do a job that I love, that I'm passionate about, that I think I know enough about. And that's the way. And I think, God, how lucky am I? You know, everybody out there says, look, do something you love and get paid for it. And I mean, I think that's what we do. So you know what? Whatever, however obscure it is, whether you're a painter, whether you're a potter, whether you're a seamstress, whatever it is, something that you love, go after it. Go after your dreams, because it's not about the money. It's just about being in a position where you say, I love getting up and love going into work.
But look, we're going to end in a lovely piece of music. But when you look at the game of rugby.
Yeah.
Are there beautiful moments? Like, we think of Brian O'Driscoll. You said once he was perhaps the greatest player of
years. I'm coming to that conclusion. I mean, interestingly, the time we're at, by March the 17th, the last match, March 16th, I think O'Driscoll may well be the greatest rugby player of all time, this Six Nations, because unlike most sportsmen, their declining years, they obviously decline. Mm. And here is O'Driscoll at the point of retirement, and he appears to be better than ever. I've never seen that happen before in any sport, you know? So he is extraordinary. He also is the most courageous person I think I've ever seen on a rugby pitch. But I don't see rugby, funny enough, as a thing of beauty. Like, I come from Cork, or Hurley, Bill O'Hurley and myself, we are tribal Cork men. So therefore,
and
hurling,
things of beauty as
no,
well.
No, hurling is a thing of beauty.
And you, yeah. Brent, as we close on
The Brian O'Driscoll, yeah, absolutely. And coming from, what did you call me earlier, superiority Kiwi or whatever. you know, Brian O'Driscoll is revered for his ability around the world, and he will go down, certainly, in my opinion, and in most New Zealanders speaking of that, as one of the greatest players of all time, without a doubt. You know, so much to admire about the guy. But can we just say something about the cycle for suicide? Because I know that when I think, you know, talking about the depression, I've lost too many friends through suicide. I'm going right back to my school days, one of my school friends, five or six since then, including three guys I played with in the same team and is in the States. You know, it is a tragedy for young people to think that there's nothing worth living for. So the cycle against suicide, I was approached for that. I do a lot of work for mental health and that. I just thought it was a brilliant idea to break the cycle, you know. So we're riding around, a number of celebrities, people are getting out there, riding to different venues, speaking at schools, going around, trying to just say, look, it's okay to be not okay. I think that's the cat phrase. And especially for young people out there to look at their lives and say, hey, there's everything to live for. If you need to talk about, you know, something maybe George and I didn't have to be able to talk to people, there are people out there that will help anybody. Speak to somebody if you're feeling a bit down. We've all got through it. We've been resilient. That's what we want to show to people, that, you know, it's okay not to be okay. You don't have to fit a stereotype. You don't have to be tall and slim or good at sport or good at music, good at anything. You just have to be good with yourself. And I think that's what we're trying to bring to the country. I think it's important now that people look at that of all ages and say, hey, there's everything to live for.
It's a very good message to close on. Best of luck with all the rugby coverage.
Yeah, I'll read Twitter. So all the Twitterati who are going to write in and abuse me, abuse away. I'll read them all.
I won't read any, so...
You've both obviously written autobiographies in recent years. Yours, Brent, called If You Really Knew Me.
Yeah.
It's available in all good bookshops,
all
as
good
they
book
say.
Shop, yeah.
George, time added on. Is it true we need to go to the library to get yours?
Have to go to the library to get it, but I'm writing, literally as we speak, I'm writing another book, but not an autobiography. I'm writing a rugby book for next Christmas.
It'll sell well.
Well, if you endorse it. I mean, if I get the
I know Miriam, nothing about rugby,
if I get
but
the
I'll read it.
Callahan endorsement.
Step of approval.
Have a great time. The Ireland-England match.
Come
everybody
on,
will be watching it. Come on, Ireland.
Exactly.
Brent Pope, George Hook, thank you very much.
You very
What's
much.
The name of this song we're going to go
out? George Strait, thinks The Breath You Take. And again, it's just a message. It's a lovely song. Listen to the lyrics of the song. I think it sums up everybody's life.
Okay, thank you both very much. I've really enjoyed having you. You're great company. My thanks on sound today to Noel Roberts, to my producer, Eileen Herron. That Cycle Against Suicide that you mentioned, Brent, is taking place between the 22nd of April and the 5th of May countrywide. And if you'd like to get involved, you can find more information on their webpage, which is cycleagainstsuicide.com. Thank you all very much for listening. I'll be here with you at the same time next week. For now, though, let's go out listening to George Strait with The Breath You Take.
Life's not the breath you take, the breathing in and out that gets you through the day ain't what it's all about. You just might miss the point trying to win the race. Life's not the breath you take, but the moments that take your breath away.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.